Welcome to another episode of the Gabe Archives Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our special guest today is DJ Brian Norwood. Welcome, Brian. Brian, you moved from your childhood home in Nashville to the city of brotherly love shortly after high school. In Philly, you were suddenly introduced to a vibrant and thriving gay bar and social scene. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so life is funny. It's circumstances are all so random. And I had been raised in Nashville, Tennessee by really Christian conservative parents, and I had been sheltered, sheltered as sheltered could possibly be. And when I got out of high school, I joined the Navy. And as chance had it, I was just I was what you would call a baby gay. And I didn't know anything really about the world because I had been sheltered so much during my entire upbringing. So when I was in the Navy, as chance had it, I went through Philadelphia for a 3-week layover before I was being shipped overseas to the Persian Gulf War or Desert Storm. This was the early 90s, probably 91, I think. And so I was in Philadelphia, and it was my first time really out in the world as an adult on my own, just untethered to anything that had to do with my past. And so me being the curious little devil that I, well, was and still am, but was at the time, I somehow found my way from the Navy base over to Center City, Philadelphia, downtown Philadelphia, which was the gay epicenter of Philadelphia. And Philadelphia just was an amazing, eye-opening kind of experience for me. So I discovered the PGN, the Philadelphia Gay News, which I assume to this day probably still exists. It was Philadelphia's gay rag, a weekly newspaper. And I found an ad in the back of the newspaper for the Chancellor Athletic Club. And little old sheltered me thought that it was a gym. I had no idea that it was a bathhouse, actually. So I went in one day with my little bag of my workout clothes and went to go work out and discovered that it was not a gym. And through a chance encounter that I had there at the Chancellor Athletic Club, I left after the 3 weeks and went and did my tour in the Navy. After I got out of the Navy, I was so enamored by Philadelphia and by that big city that I just was blown away by. I actually moved to Philadelphia after I got out of the Navy. And I have to say that those were really amongst the best days of my life. I got a job as a bar back at the premier gay bar in Philadelphia, and it was called Woody's. Woody's was an institution then, and it's actually still an institution now. It's set right on the corner of 13th and Chestnut Streets, no, 13th and Walnut Streets. And it was the place to see and be seen. And I, through having my job there as a bar back there, kind of naturally, because I was in the bar like 5 or 6 nights a week, just had a natural kind of introduction to the bar crowds that were coming out every night to Woody's. And Woody's was not a club per se. They did add a dance bar component onto the bar, but from its beginning, it was always kind of a video standaround bar. And I have to say, those were the best days of my life. I made the best friends. I'm actually still friends to this day, 30, 30 years later, still friends to this day with the people that I met during those days when I started working at Woody's. Through that friendship network that I became part of in Philadelphia, my knowledge of the gay culture kind of expanded. The friendship network that I kind of fell into, they were the what I would call the they were the real party crowd of Philadelphia. These were the guys that were going to New York City and kind of traveling all over the country to circuit parties that were in their infancy in that time. And so I made the best friends with people that are still my friends to this day. Philadelphia had great bars that were all walking distance. The thing I loved so much about Philadelphia was that all the bars were within walking distance. I didn't have a car, and you never needed a car to get from any of the bars. And so you could literally go from point A to point B to C, D, E, and F all within a couple of hour period, just kind of roaming the streets. And Philadelphia's community was large enough that it was a large community, but it was also small enough that it was very tight knit. Everybody knew everybody pretty much. And if you didn't know people specifically, you at least recognized them. And so, Philadelphia had great after hours clubs also. There was one in the alley right across from Woody's that was called the 2-4 Club. The 2-4 Club operates in legend in Philadelphia because back in the old days, it used to be open 24 hours a day. Back in the old, and it's a huge mega club. Back in the old days, there used to be a dump truck in the upper, an actual dump truck in the upper level of the club. It was extraordinary. Somewhere along the way that dump truck was taken out, but it was a legit club. So every night after we would be done at the bar at 2 o'clock, we would then go to the after hours bars. And then even after the after hours bars, we would even have, like little intimate morning parties where there might be six of us or 20 of us. It just depended on the night, but it was a very close knit scene. And I'm very fortunate to have been part of that culture at that time. And the bars were the epicenter of our culture. They were our gathering places. Best memories of my life.
Now, you obviously, the gay bar scene in Philadelphia was a big part of molding your gay persona, allowing you to express your gay self that you were not able to do before then. But it also molded and nurtured your passion for music and the art of DJing. How did that evolve? And who were your primary mentors or influencers that kind of supported you in the pursuit of the art of DJing?
Yeah, so that's great memories also. So those friends that I made in the bars in Philadelphia, like I said, they were the kind of the party crowd. They were the crowd that wasn't afraid to go to Atlanta or New York City or Chicago. These were the traveling party crowd. And we went out close to seven nights a week, probably to the bars in Philadelphia. But we also were this crowd that befriended me also used to go to other cities a lot. Probably 1993 or 1994, but I would say it was probably 93. My friends invited me up to New York City to take me to a Saint at Large party at Roseland. I had no clue what it was. I didn't really understand the concept and didn't really know what to expect. So my friends took me to the White Party, and I literally lost my mind at the party. I remember probably at 8 o'clock in the morning, standing at the end of Roseland. You know, Roseland was a long, rectangular, kind of squarish space. The DJ booth was up, you know, in a window, like on the far end of Roseland. And I remember at about 8 o'clock in the morning, standing at the far end of the room at this, you know, kind of on the edge of the dance floor, and just looking up and hearing everything I was hearing and seeing everything I was seeing, and saying to myself, oh my gosh, I am going to do this. I'm going to give this. Because music had always been a strong part of my identity, both consciously and subconsciously growing up. And I remember thinking, I'm going to do this. So I literally went back to Philadelphia and I saved up my money. And I remember saving $600. And in those days, $600 was a lot of money. And I saved up enough money to buy myself two turntables and a mixer and speakers and my first batch of records. And I literally started teaching myself to spin, and spinning in general, but particularly spinning in vinyl is very difficult. You don't just get it. You really do have to keep at it and keep at it and keep at it if you want to be a master of it. And so I kept at it and I kept chipping away, I think the community in Philadelphia saw that I was different. They saw that there was something bigger about my approach to it all than just the local, you know, DJs that were spinning, you know, at the local spots around town. And I also was in with a crowd that was very open-minded, and they were following DJs like Susan Morabito, Michael Fearman, and Buck. I think I would single out those three DJs as the three biggest influences on me for a couple of reasons. And I consider myself so blessed that they were my influences. I consider myself blessed because of the time that I came into the culture and what I got out of it because of the time that I was in it. So in that time, the circuit was really just in its infancy. Now, the Saint in New York had been kind of an institution by that point, even since the 80s. And New York was, what was going on there was fierce, and it was amazing. And it was kind of, you would say, the birthing ground of that culture. But then it started spreading to the rest of the country. And at that time, around 93, 94, the circuit itself was just beginning to bloom out into the rest of the country. It wasn't confined to just New York City. It was spreading everywhere. It was amazing. And so I was this little baby in the gay culture. And I was being influenced by Michael Fearman, Susan Morabito, and Buck. And these were DJs that really taught me to tell stories through the night of music. It wasn't, you know, I think one thing that today's generation has been robbed of to a degree is that stories are not told like they used to be. And so they taught me how to tell stories and have there be a beginning and then a crescendo and then an end to the night. And it all have distinctly different feels to it so that it was very nuanced and it was touching. So the circuit, you know, the circuit still exists, obviously, but I think that back in those days, it was a lot smaller and it was a lot more, the knit to it was tighter. And I was very fortunate to not only have been influenced by those three DJs that I speak of, and I was influenced by so many more, but I would say that I was influenced by the three of those, not only artistically, but humanly. I was, and I would say of those three, probably Buck, God rest his soul, was the biggest influence on me, both as a human being, but also as an artist. Yeah.
Now, over the years, you've developed a kind of distinctive style for your mixes. And as I understand it from previous conversations we've had, they're sort of a tribute to the heyday of circuit that you were just talking about. Talk about your music then and how it has evolved now.
Yes. Yeah, so remember a few minutes ago, I touched on the fact that I consider myself blessed that I came of age when I did. I do consider myself an artist, a real artist. And I think that, and I have to be careful here because I have to be careful about the way I state this, but you know, listen, an artist is supposed to be telling their story, and they should have their touch on it. And I was very fortunate to come of age when I did because of how meaningful and how touching the music was. And so there was a style of music that was really big back in those days called morning music. And the morning music was the time of the night when the crowd had thinned out a little bit at the club or the bar or the party, and the music came down in intensity and the dance floor thinned somewhat, but the feeling of the bar or the club or the party, there was a touch that washed over the environment, and it became different. There was a love and a community that's really, really almost hard to explain that was even missing even at that same party 3 or 4 hours previously. And the music dictated that. And I got lucky and I came of age when that was how it was done. And so instead of it being pounding beats at 8 a.m., it was beautiful, heartfelt, touching morning music that was being made in places like England and Italy, and it was all being imported into the United States. And so that style of music made a huge impression on me, and it very much shaped me as an artist that has even kind of come into this modern age now. And because I came from that moment in time, I have a big love for that because those were some of the best times in my life was those morning time hours. And so now as a DJ, I've kind of taken it upon myself to kind of keep that going. But I don't want to keep it going by playing the same music that was being played during that time, because we already heard all that. And I don't want to hear it again. You know, I mean, I'm an artist. I want to keep moving forward, and I want to keep kind of, in a way, kind of challenging myself. And I also want to keep the eyes on tomorrow, not yesterday. But while I'm doing all this, I think that it's important that I do keep yesterday in remembrance to drive what it is that I'm doing today. And so Buck never played old music, really. He was all about me playing new music that was fresh, and it was by emerging bands and artists from places like, you know, like I said, England and Germany and Italy and all over the world. And today, now as an artist, I want to be that person who is bringing those artists of today into the ears and the hearts and the minds of today's listeners. Now, we live in a very different time than 20 years ago. But that doesn't mean that we can't still affect people with that music. And so although we're not really playing that music on dance floors anymore, per se, although I do still play parties and I do still play like loungy types of situations, and there is still venues and times and parties for that sound. what we've got now is podcasting. And so I've taken it upon myself to bring that morning music into today, keep it fresh, keep it new, keep it young in a way, because all of these artists that I'm playing and I'm discovering, they're bands of today. They weren't even around making music, 20 years ago. And so I've made it my mission to keep touching people with that same sensibility that we were doing on dance floors 20 years ago at 8 o'clock in the morning. I'm now doing it in people's cars, and I'm doing it for people in their headphones at the gym. And I'm doing it in retail establishments that play my music. And I've brought it into today, and I've been able to stay true to myself as an artist, even though culture changed. And so in a way, culture changed, but I didn't. I've never changed. I've always been the same me, and I always will be the same me. But just making sure that my approach is thoughtful and that it is well thought out. And so I think it's important for me to know my history and to give a nod to my history, but also to be looking forward as an artist, because that's what makes me feel like that I'm actually being an artist.
Right. And in the same vein, if Picasso was still alive, or Warhol's a perfect example. If Warhol was still alive, he would be doing, portraits of Lady Gaga. He wouldn't be continuing to do portraits of, someone who was famous 30 years ago. He would be memorializing and putting his artistic twist on something that is relevant to today's society. And that's pretty much what you're doing with your music, is you're taking the style of what was done 20 or 30 years ago and interpreting today's music in that way, so that people that are young and vibrant and out now can appreciate, both the music and your interpretation of it.
Yes, exactly. It's important to carve out your own lane in this culture. And as we have become more accepted and in society, and our culture has changed greatly, I've had to change along with it. But at the same time, it's been super important to me to innately at my core not change. And I feel that I've done a good job with that. And I will tell you, I serve a great purpose to a lot of people. Many people who follow me are from the old days, and many, many, many people just discovered me last week or last month. And I love it. And so I'm really happy to still have the ability to bring love and peace and happiness through my approach to it all.
Right. And as people can tell from the images that I've added into this video of your different album covers and events and things, you're pretty prolific at this. You're not the kind of DJ that does, one mix a year and puts it out there. You've got a huge catalog of different mixes in different genres as well. You have a lot of morning music, but you have, the deep sophisticated and these different types of mixes that people could listen to you for days and never have to listen to the same thing twice. There's quite a body of work out there. A few years ago, I attended a private party where you were spinning to a crowd of very enthusiastic music aficionados. It was kind of a throwback to the Atlanta's Clan of the Hand Wavers tribe, which was Buck was an original member. Steve Berman was an original member. And it was hosted by one of the original members, Chris Dillahay, at his loft in Atlanta. And it felt to me kind of like what you were explaining as the old days of circuit, when it was a group of people that were, enjoying the music. They were enjoying the environment and each other. And there was a variety of types of music played over the course of the party. How did that feel for you?
Well, there's one word that just immediately pops into my mind, and it's home. Home. Those are the parties, and those are the people and the crowds that are just, they're everything to me. It's so much joy and so much fun to do and be part of that sometimes I don't even know how to explain it. Those are what I live for. When I'm in a DJ booth playing to in that type of a space with those types of people, it's like family. It's home. There's a total sense of comfort. There's also a sense of safety. I remember that night that you're referencing. I felt so safe and so loved and so perfectly happy, 100% happy. And I might have only known 40% of the people there, but I was in love with 100% of the people, because those people that even that I didn't know were friends with my friends. And if they were friends with my friends, then they were my friends. And that's something that you just can't put a price on. You can barely put words to it to explain how beautiful and remarkable it is, and how blessed we are, how blessed I am. But as a culture, how blessed we are as a culture to have that. And I think it's really important to have that kind of stuff. You know, communities are only as strong as what people put into them. And I hope until the day I die that I will be strong in that culture, contributing to it, and surrounded by people that are also contributing, because it's what makes our life so rich and beautiful. So hard for me to put into words, but it's really a beautiful thing.
Well, that was, you know, that event is kind of a tribute to the way the circuit culture originated, because it wasn't just a house party where somebody said, hey, we're going to have a dozen people over here and we're going to have some music. I mean, when you look at the pictures of it, the amount of detail that went into, you know, thinking out the invitation design, doing the decoration, the LED lights that were everywhere, you know, the whole thematic development, pairing it with the concept of resurrection, which both, of course, goes with Easter and with resurrecting the circuit scene, the homemade Easter bonnet contest. The whole thing was like a major bar production that you would have expected at somewhere like the Saint or whatever, but on a smaller, you know, private loft scale. And that, I think, contributes to the energy of what the circuit family was all about originally.
Yeah. I mean, nothing was half done. Not only was it not half done, but it was over the top. It was extraordinary. Like you said, the amount of detail that was put into the invitations and the people getting dressed up. And it was so much fun. Like, it was a lot of work, but so much fun. I mean, that's the kind of fun that it's not easy to have. And that's the reason it's really important to have a culture and a community that's made up of people that are willing to put in that effort. And I just am blessed, always was and always will be, to be surrounded by those people. It's pretty special.
Yeah. In fact, that event, they even flew in a special DJ from out of state. I think his name was Brian Norwood. Do you know him?
I've heard of him. Yeah.
So another thing that's kind of changing in our culture these days that I've seen in numerous cities as I'm researching, you know, the history of gay bars, is the evolution of more private or after hours clubs. You know, there are no longer really very many clubs that can serve alcohol 24 hours a day. And so the private clubs, which are alcohol free generally, can stay open and do the kind of events that you're used to spinning for. In Atlanta, Tokyo Valentino has made quite a mark on the late night scene there and completely remodeled a space that was once basically just video booths into an energetic all night, you know, entertainment space. How do you respond to this trend? And could you see yourself spinning in that type of an environment?
So that I'm 100% all for that culture. And again, sometimes I'm opinionated just like everybody else is. And so I should tread carefully when I say what I'll say. Let me see how to say this. I personally never loved playing to a crowd, alcohol crowds. There was a different expectation for what you needed to do and really must do if you were to be accepted into the bar culture as a whole. So I have the best memories from bars and I go to them to this day and I cherish them because they're a central part of our community. But as an artist, as a person, as a DJ, I never found my home in bars per se, because alcohol fueled those bars and alcohol spoke to a different culture than the type of music that I was into spoke to. And so I was naturally always kind of DJing to a crowd that was not necessarily your alcohol crowd. That's the most basic way I know how to put that. And so now fast forward to this day, this is outstanding that there's a resurgence of after hours bars and clubs that do not focus on alcohol service. Because, you know, it's completely possible to go out and have the most blinding fun and have alcohol be no part of it. Alcohol doesn't need to be part of that fun. And if you can have an establishment that is able to have more extended hours and alcohol not be part of it, I'd actually rather be part of that. I'd rather... Those are people that tend to be a little bit more open-minded. You know, I'm talking about the whole, you know, you have to talk about who is your target audience, what is their mindset? And the type of person that's going to like a Tokyo Valentino, they're naturally, innately, they're going to tend to be a bit of a more open-minded person. I don't really know why that is, but through years and years and years of market research, shall I say, I can say that I've seen it unequivocally. The person who goes to a Tokyo Valentino is going to kind of let you do whatever you want artistically. Whereas the person who goes to, say, Woody's in Philadelphia, the stand around video bar, they are not, they're not there to go on that journey, shall I say, musically. So I am all for the resurgence of after hours clubs, spots, businesses that are kind of catering to a more open-minded crowd. You know, listen, we need to evolve as a people. And I think that anything you can do to provide an atmosphere where people can kind of like be free and let go, it's a great thing. I would actually, in fact, speaking of Tokyo Valentino, I would actually love to to spend there. I haven't before. I do know of that establishment because I did used to live in Atlanta, and I was always very familiar with that business. To me, it would be a dream to play there, actually. As an artist, I kind of have two kind of sides to me. We've spoken a lot about my morning music, and I've spoken about that love and peace and happiness and that touch. Well, there's also a whole other sound that belongs in those morning time hours. It's a very deep kind of, it's a deep house music. And it's soothing, and it's beautiful, and it's there's a touch to it, but it's also got kind of not a darker, but it's got a more nighttime feel. So I would love to be able to go into a spot like Tokyo Valentino and play that sound that you don't have, you're not trying to necessarily beat people over the head on a dance floor with. It can be a more nuanced, a more sexy, sophisticated sound. And that's the exact type of place that I could play that sound. And there's not too many places where you could actually play that sound. So I'm all for it, big time. It
And that's your sophisticated deep.
is, yes. Oh, that's great that you kind of zero in on that. Yes, that is more my deep sound. So, I've always had a love for progressive house and deep house and trance. So as an artist through all these years, I've kind of realized that I'm kind of like a yin and yang. I'm like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde with my music, but it's all rooted in sensibility. It's all rooted in morning time hours. So my sophisticated morning series is all very vocal oriented. It's a touch pop oriented, but it's not commercial pop. It's more emotional, kind of indie pop. It's a little hard to explain, but it's a very specific sound, and it's what you would call the prettier side of morning music, my sophisticated morning sound. But then deep house also has a whole nother genre. There's a whole nother component to that that's more of like a deeper, more hypnotic, a sexier, it's almost, excuse my language, but you could almost call it like baby making music. It's like sexy. It's like stuff you could have sex with. It's baby making music. It's definitely more meant for the nighttime. Largely, there's no words, not a lot of words, but you don't need the words. And so I developed the Sophisticated Deep series to kind of cater to those people that are more into the nighttime side of the morning sound versus the daytime sound of like my morning mixes. And I have to tell you, my sophisticated deep mixes are as popular, if not more popular, than my sophisticated morning mixes. And my sophisticated morning mixes, I've been doing podcasting for 11 years now. Nonstop, hammering those things out, literally 2 or 3 a month sometimes. Whereas my sophisticated deep sound is something that I have more developed in like just the last couple of years, maybe 2 years. But I've noticed that the culture has really navigated as much to my deep sound as they have to the morning sound. And interestingly enough, I want a place to be able to play that deep music. And those after-hours types of clubs are exactly what that type of music is kind of made for. So.
Well, unfortunately, with your social media presence, your Facebook, SoundCloud, Podomatic, Instagram, everywhere that you are, people can actually go and listen to some of these mixes and sample your style and know exactly what you're talking about, without having to try to travel to somewhere that you're spinning. And any of these people that operate clubs can easily go to the links that we're posting at the end here so that they can see exactly what you're talking about and look at that huge volume of work that you've put together, up to this very day.
Yeah, I mean that's the whole reason I do my podcasting is because I realized as an artist, oh my gosh, I realized back 2010, 2011, culture had already started changing by that point, and I realized that club culture, bar culture, party culture was moving in a different direction commercially, and I speak commercially. Than where I was as an artist and where I was willing to go. I was not willing to go there because I felt like that I was going to be, having to sell out my soul to be famous. And I remember many years ago that I made a concerted decision to intentionally say, okay, I'm not going to be dance floor famous. I'm not going to be playing the party for 3,000 people, at this circuit weekend. And I could have done that. I knew the people. I was part of the culture. And I intentionally said, no, I won't do that because I feel like that for me personally, other DJs, I can't speak for them. And so this has nothing to do with other ones. But for me personally, I wanted to continue on the path. Well, podcasting gave me the ability to continue on that path. And the interesting thing is that people out there have gravitated to me through that podcasting. I've taken it very seriously, and I've treated it as much like a business as I have as my artistic expression. Because as if you're to be a successful DJ and artist, well, then you do have to, in a way, treat it as a business. And so the podcasting was a very intentional decision on my part to get it out there to thousands of people all over the world who I knew needed to hear my music. And they were not going to hear it otherwise because they were not going to hear me in a bar or a club or a party. But the interesting thing that's happened over the years is that through me, in a way, finding those people and all those people finding me through the podcasting, and because it can be listened to all over the world, people started booking me to play parties that I actually would have never gotten had it not been the podcasting. I've played all over the world to some degree through that podcasting. And the great thing is that because those people discovered me and they know exactly what I'm about through all of that music that I'm giving out consistently, they're booking me for the right reasons. They're booking me and they already know from the very beginning what I'm all about and what I'm going to give their crowds. And the great thing is that there's still crowds out there that want exactly what I'm giving. So it's almost like a fairy tale story that I've been able to figure out my lane through all of this and stay very, very, very true to myself all along the way.
And, the kind of cool thing about this, from my perspective, is because my whole project has been about, archiving the history of gay bars and how they were important to the evolution of the gay community, both socially and politically. In your case, it turns out that not only did the gay bars introduce you to gay life, but they also gave you an opportunity to express your musical talents and to connect with a whole family of people who are as passionate about music as you are. So it really had an important impact that a lot of people just kind of brush aside because these days the club scene is not the same. I think in a lot of ways, just like you were saying with music, the club scene has become almost commercial. It's a big, there's a big space, 500 people go in there, they hang with the six people they came with, they get drunk, they listen to the same music they're hearing on the radio, and then they watch, maybe a local drag show or something, and they go home. And they never interact with the other people. There's no bond. because there's nothing unique about the experience. And that's a complete 180 from when you came into the scene and everything was about the unique experience and people bonding because of common interests in music and dancing and, you know, the other passions that they had about exploring their sexuality or relationships. So it's kind of brought you from where you were to where you are today.
Yeah, it's all connected. Every bit of it is all connected. And that's the reason I said earlier how blessed I considered myself to have come of age when I did. Here to make myself sound like an old timer for a second, I actually feel so bad for today's generation that's coming of age now, because like you said, they're all going to these parties, but there's no connection. They're with their six friends, but there's no family. There's no tightly wound, tightly knit. The fabric is not tightly knit. And from when and where I came from, it was very tightly knit. And we had each other's backs, and it was a true community. It was a culture. It was a community and a culture. And with me specifically, gay bars, not clubs, even in my case, bars, because Philadelphia was a big bar city. It even in a way is still to this day. Bars are what I owe many of my long enduring 30-year friendships to. I don't know that I would have got, I don't know if I would be where I'm at right now had it not been for that era that I came out of. So I thank my lucky stars every day. I do.
And we thank our lucky stars that you took that route, because you brought a lot of smiles to a lot of people's faces. You make them happy, sometimes a little sad, listening to the music that you play for them. And it's what it's all about. It's about the emotion and about the connection. And you have certainly played your part in honing that art and creating the series of mixes that you have over the years. So you've played your own part in this story.
Well, remember what I said earlier about how important it is for that communities are not accidents. Communities are only as strong as the people that are contributing, and they're doing their part to make it what it is. And I am very proud and very honored to be doing my part both then and now to make our community special. Because that's what we're all trying to live for, is to be special and to be part of something special. And we're only as strong as the contributions that we all make. Yeah.
Well, we certainly appreciate your contributions. And any of the people who are watching this video, these are the places on social media where you'll be able to follow Brian, whether it's Facebook, SoundCloud, Podomatic, or Instagram. You can just go to any of those sites. You can listen to his music. You can even send him a private message and say, hey, I love your stuff. Because, you know, Brian's all about interacting with his community, and he loves what he does, and we can see it. Thank you, Brian.
Oh, Art, thank you so much. I really appreciate being part of all this, okay?
Oh, you're quite welcome. Yeah. And that concludes another segment of the Gabe Archives podcast. You can find more podcasts at gabearchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.